Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the rest of our conversation with 96-year-old Joe Peterburz of Roseville, California. When we left off, the ace fighter pilot turned ex-prisoner of war had just been reunited with American forces after some time spent fighting with a Soviet unit.
So I go with the patrol back to Holly, which was a big Air Force unit, but that patrol's unit, its headquarters was there. So we go out at a couple of patrols. I go out on a couple of patrols with them and picking up souvenirs. And we'd roust all the people out of the town and tell them to bring all their weapons to the town square and pile them up and stuff like that. Picked up a few, played a lot of poker with the army guys that got me drunk and won all my good souvenirs and that sort of stuff. But anyway, a lot of fun. But I got tired of it. I was there for, I think, 2 days. And so I said, I'm going to take off. So I just took off and started walking down the road and walked probably 5, 6, 7 miles. And there's a C-47 parked in an open field. And there's about 10 or 12 people in striped suits, emaciated, standing around the C-47. And then there are two lieutenants flying it, pilot, co-pilot. And I go over and I say, hey, where are you going? He says, Paris. He says, what's this? Oh, he says, well, they're liberated political prisoners. We're taking them back to Paris. And I said, well, I could come along. He says, yeah. And I thought, what better than that? Yeah, go to Paris. Big mistake. And end up in Paris, and there I'm deloused, tagged, and officially a reclaimed POW. And I am under control of my life of wandering over Europe.
Maybe for your own good.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you said something earlier, very early on. You said that the day you got shot down, your thought was with your mother.
Yeah.
Who's already lost one of her sons in this war. And what is she going to know? What is she going to hear? I'm sure you were able to piece that together later about what information she had after you were shot down.
Yeah, well, immediately they had telegrams going out to say that I was liberated and stuff because I was still missing in action. You know, I wasn't notified as a POW. None of that stuff would have processed itself back into the system. So as far as everybody knew, I was still missing in action.
So she didn't know you were alive until when?
Well, until she got the message saying that I've been repatriated.
And then did you go home and see her?
Well, yeah, I went home to get married.
Well, that's a big piece of the story, too.
Yeah, my fiance, Josephine, I named my aircraft after her. Anyway, I go back on the last convoy and get to Fort Sheridan by... I arrived in the States on the 1st of June and then on Fort Sheridan about the 5th of June, I think it was. And then back into Milwaukee and then immediate arrangements. And, of course, my mother's elated. And my two brothers, my brother Bill, who was stationed at Fort Marmouth, and my brother George was home, too. So she had her three sons back from the war and they're planning my wedding. So... We got married on the 13th of June of 1945 and had a 60-day leave and then added another 30 days onto that. So we had 90 days, 30 days up in Wisconsin Dells on our honeymoon. Mm. But anyway, when I got married, I had to get my mom's permission to get married because I hadn't turned 21 yet. But Josephine was 20 and women were liberated, I guess, when they were 18 or whatever.
Well, I think we have to put some other dots together here, too, because if folks remember, before Pearl Harbor, you were in seminary. Mm-hmm. You had made the decision you're going to be a Catholic priest, which comes with a vow of celibacy. You're never going to be married.
Oh, yeah.
So somewhere along the path from going into the Army Air Corps to coming home as a liberated prisoner of war,
Okay, you want
that story changed.
Story,
I mean, huh? That's a big part. That's a big change from going to be a priest to, hey, I'm getting married as soon as I get back to the States.
Okay, when I was in the seminary during summer vacation, I got a job at St. Joseph's Hospital where I was a handy boy, cutting grass and cleaning up stuff in the hospital and this sort of thing. And there was a beautiful little girl of blue eyes and 5 foot tall and that I saw. And we became very good friends, platonic, truly and really, a really, truly platonic relationship. And that was for the two summers before the war started. Then when the war started and I was going in, I knew that I had to concentrate on what I was going to be doing. Number one, I could have a relationship type of thing going on. And besides that, I had, it was platonic at the time. And we didn't even think about talking about marriage or anything like that. So I go off and finish my training. And then when I graduate, second lieutenant, I have a leave before I go on to further training to Milwaukee, and I go back to show off myself at the hospital to all the bunch of old Germans that work there, and they, when I say old, I'm talking about 35 or 40 years old, to me at the time were old. And anyway, I'm walking by the cafeteria, and I see group of four girls sitting there eating, and one of them was Josephine. And I think maybe by that time my dedication to becoming a priest had sort of waned a little bit. And so I walked over and I said, "Hi, Joe." And here I'm in my, pinks and greens and silver wings and handsome guy.
Yeah, I've seen pictures.
And
yeah,
all the girls are swooning. And so anyway, they all are breathtakingly waiting till Joe gives her that answer. And she looks up and says, "Well, anytime. Yeah. When do you want to go out?" "Tonight."
What did you think?
Yeah. And then we started our relationship. So then we wrote daily when I went back to training and stuff. And then before I went overseas, I had another leave. And I proposed to her. We were in the living room and by herself, and she was sitting on the couch, and I got down on my knees, and I had the big old diamond engagement ring. Not really big, a little tiny one.
It's all relative.
Yeah. And I proposed to her, and she looked down, and she had a tear in her eye, and she said yes. And so that was the beginning of a 60-year love affair.
And it underscores what you said earlier, that you really never thought there was a chance you wouldn't come back, because I'm sure you wouldn't have done that if you didn't think you were coming back.
Yeah.
That was something pretty important to get back for.
Right. Absolutely.
Wow, that's neat. I'm glad you included that. And then the other thing that hits me, Joe, is all this stuff you went through in World War II. I mean, you lost a brother. You almost lost your own life. You saw friends of yours get killed. You have to endure life as a prisoner, even getting caught up in another country's army at the end of the war. All these things you went through. For some people, I think that would have been enough. They would have been ready to jump out of the Army Air Corps after the war. Why did you stay in? And you didn't stay in for just a few years, 36 years.
Yeah. Well, no, my dad had been in,
Yeah.
And I had made up my mind sometime along this way, the period I was in, that I was going to make it a career. I talked it over with Jill, and she was amenable. We knew what the thing was, moving, and hard, bring up a family and all that sort of stuff with it. But we both agreed that that'd be it, so that we made a joint decision that I'd go ahead and stay in. It was really field. The first, right after the war, got back after things settled down, and I finally got my assignment. My first assignment after my leaves was back to Dothan, Alabama, to Napier. Oh, by the way, I was doing all this flight and everything before I ever got a car license to drive a car.
Couldn't drive a car, but you could fly a
when I came
P-51.
When I came home from the war, I learned how to drive a car. Anyway, it was Dothan. We get there. It's open a week, and they close the field. So up to Truex Field, Wisconsin. We're there for a month, and they close the field. And then we go down to Chanute in Illinois, And there we stayed for 3 years. And while there, I'm commander of, this is 1945 to 1948. And I'm commander of a all-black unit, 400-plus men. And I'm not 20 years old yet. Haven't turned 21 yet, and still...
And that's right when President Truman is integrating the armed forces.
That's where I'm coming to.
Yeah.
I'm commander, and he desegregates. So it's my responsibility to be able to smoothly and efficiently and without any problems integrate my units, my men, into the white units.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the difference is, see, the all-black units, they were segregated. They were all different MOSs, specialties. And then the white units, the specialties was the squadron, you know, all the engineers and that sort of stuff. All the military police were together and this sort of thing. So it was, I had to determine, you know, which units they would be going to and to integrate them. And it took a good year before I got the last. I had a system of spies and this sort of thing that would let me know if there's any, you know, there was
if there were incidents.
Yeah, incidents and this sort of stuff. And I got a pretty good job. So in June of 47, I was promoted to captain at 22, I think I was going on, or mm-hmm. was 22.
Well, and again, there's another story that really only you can tell on that. And I've talked to a lot of the African-American pilots, you know, who flew in World War II in these segregated units. And, you know, they had a lot of different stories of how they were treated, of what they were trying to prove.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a feel for what some of them had been through? And were there some challenges that you faced in assigning them to these now integrated units for the first time?
Well, I had a pretty good idea because all my training was in the Southeast. And, you know, and I got in trouble a couple of times, or almost officially in trouble, because of my lack of adherence to their Jim Crow laws and all that sort of stuff. The bubbler, the movies, and, they'd have the balcony, they'd have segregated, you'd go into the department, all the store, you know, whites only, and, you know, drinking fountains, toilets, everything. And coming from Wisconsin, I say my only association, we had one African-American seminarian in my class, and I got to know him pretty well, and, you know, we got along swell. And so I had an idea, but I also knew that I was 21 years old, and when I took over command of this unit, and that the first sergeant was a 20-year veteran, and I knew who could run the outfit. He was my right arm and left arm in running the outfit. So I didn't do anything without his counsel and so on. So we ran the outfit together.
And he was white or black?
Black. I was the only white person.
You're the only white guy?
Only white person.
With 400 black pilots?
Yeah, not pilots.
Of all...
Well, cooks, bakers, employees, whatever the jobs were, mechanics. So
that sounds like something you're proud of.
Oh, I am. Yeah, I really, you know, I could still see he is always sort of standing over my shoulder, and he'd keep me on the straight and narrow.
It's break time again, but there's more to come with 96-year-old retired Air Force Colonel Joe Peterburz. How many missions did he fly during the Korean War? And how was it that he came to meet the German ace he had shot down moments before Joe was shot down in 1945? Hear those details as only he can share them when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. see for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.